ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिबोधिदां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन ग्रथिदां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीं अम्ब त्वामनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणीम् यं ब्रह्मा वरुणेन्द्ररुद्रमरुदस्तु नन्दि दिव्यैस्तवैः वेदैः साङ्गपदक्रमोपनिषदैः गायन्ति यं सामगाः ध्यानावस्थिततद्गतेन मनसा पश्यन्ति यं योगिनो यस्यान्दं न विदुःसुरासुरगणाः देवाय तस्मै नमः We are continuing our discussion on the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. In the last session, we discussed the 22nd verse, which in effect says the central principle that it puts forward is that life is a continuing phenomenon. Death is not the end of our journey of life. Death is not a full stop. Death is only a comma in this continuing journey. And this body comes and goes. So the verse is, Vasamsi jirnani yatha vihaya navani grinnahi naroparani tatha sarirani vihaya jirnani Anyani samyati navani dehi. So just as we threw away a torn, worn out clothes and start wearing a new set of clothes, so also when a person dies, he doesn't really die, he only changes his body. Just as he changes, he throws away the old cloth and he changes his dress, that's all. He is not worried. So the central principle put forward the idea, there is something in us, our true nature, which is deathless, which is immortal, which is unchanging. It doesn't disappear when the body disappears. It doesn't change, the mind changes. It remains eternal, immortal, unchanging. And nothing can destroy that absolute reality. And it cannot be brought to any kind of change. It remains same. That's our true nature. So if you can look upon your own body, as, say, you look upon this chair in front of you, you don't say this chair that you see in front of you is yourself. It's a chair that you sit on. After some time you may sit on another chair. Or you're holding a stick in your hand. If somebody hits the stick, you don't feel the pain because the stick is not part of your body mechanism. So also this body itself is an outer mechanism, an instrument. And beyond this body, and even beyond this mind, beyond this intellect, there is the real I, which remains same. Now, from a purely practical, pragmatic point of view, it has got one great advantage, you know. When we feel that we have just $100 in the bank, you'd be very careful to spend $50 because that means you have just only $50 left. But suppose you have got $1 billion in the bank, you don't worry about spending $50 or $100. If we can think of something other than this physical body, something other than this mind and intellect, then we feel that we feel a kind of inner enrichment. We feel enriched within. And that's what Vedanta is talking about. Vedanta doesn't talk about a God sitting somewhere whom you should obey and love, who insists on your obedience and your loyalty and your love. That idea is not rejected, but Vedanta takes you beyond that without rejecting it. So the 23rd verse is the beginning of a long discussion of this eternal, immortal, unchanging reality, which is our true nature. 23rd verse, chapter 2nd. Nayanam chindanti shastrani, nayanam dehati pavakaha, na chayanam kledayantyapo, na shoshayeti marutaha. So, you know, this discussion continues. Achedyoyam, adakhyoyam, akledya, asyosha evaja, nitya sarvagadasthanuhu, acheloyam sanatanaha. This discussion continues. What it says is, this Atman, which is actually our true nature, weapons cannot pierce it, fire cannot burn it, water cannot moisten it, and wind cannot dry it. That means, see, no, normally whatever we interact with in this empirical world are things that could be affected by wind, by fire. Maybe a sharp instrument can pierce a vegetable or a banana. A wet place can be dried by strong winds. A highly inflammable thing can be burned by fire. These are things that happen in the empirical world. All that you find at the empirical world undergoes some kind of change in course of time. Even this earth itself, well, the earth itself may be 4.5 billion years old, if you believe in that universe. But before that, it was not like this, or did not exist as it is existing today. Or maybe after several more years, billions of years, millions of years, it may be somewhat different. So it changes. So the whole universe itself undergoes change. An insect undergoes change within minutes. The cosmos undergoes change in billions of years. But change is real. And whatever changes is within time. It cannot be called immortal. It cannot be called eternal. It belongs to time. It belongs to space. Now, Vedanta tells you all these things belong to the empirical relative plane. So in Sanskrit, tradition is called Vyavaharika Satta. Vyavahara means pragmatic usage, utility. It's a common sense understanding. Satta means reality, the ontological concept of what is real, what is sat. Now, everything in this world, which burns, which gets dried, belong to this empirical plane. That is subject to changes. So also our mind, so also our body, so also intellect. Mind changes, happy now, unhappy after some time. Body gets old. After 100 years, our body will disappear. But there is something that doesn't disappear when the body disappears. That is the beginning of a discussion. A very important discussion in the Bhagavad Gita, 22nd verse, Vasvamsi Jirnani Yatha Vikaya. So Lord Krishna is coming down to our level. See, look at your own body. If you live a healthy life every day, if you do exercise 100 years, and still you have to change the cloth. That is, the body have to change. It doesn't mean that you have to remain naked for the rest of your lifetime. You buy a new set of clothes. So also, the Jivatma, the individual soul, undergoes the cyclic transmigration from life cycle to life cycle at the empirical plane. But that is only part of the picture. That is only that part of the iceberg which is visible above the water level. Below that, there's a huge iceberg that is invisible. So Vedanta tells you there is something far beyond this. That is Paramarthika Satta. That is the absolute reality. The eternal, the immortal, the unchanging reality, which neither the body, nor the mind, nor the intellect, nor the psychophysical mechanism, and that is our true nature. So, this Atman is described by the Lord in terms of the mutable and ever-changing world, which is familiar to all of us. Something that burns, something that gets wet, something gets dried, we know. Now, if you observe that, you should remember there is something which is different from that. What is that? This Atman. So it is something which weapons cannot pierce, water cannot wet, and winds cannot dry. That's the Atman. So this is Paramarthika Satta. That is our true identity. Everything else is a false identity. In fact, even in ordinary practical life, if we can think of ourselves as something beyond the body, as I mentioned earlier, then bodily problems will not have a devastating effect on our life. I gave the example of Stephen Hawking. Many such examples, Helen Keller, many people who were deaf and even blind, still made great contribution to human civilization, such pictures, personalities you can find in all civilizations, because they could think of themselves other than the body and mind. It doesn't mean that they have realized their transcendental spiritual identity, but they succeeded in effecting an ascent, taking their consciousness beyond the bodily level. Though they have not identified the Paramarthika dimension. So once we realize this, then we can look at this world, but still we won't be shocked or we won't be overwhelmed by what happens at the empirical plane. The world is subject to changes. Everything other than this Atman is bound to change. So why should we expect impermanence in things which are essentially inherently... why should we expect permanence in things which are essentially impermanent? Why should we expect perfection in things which are essentially imperfect? Why should we expect changelessness, continuity in things which are subject to changes, which will not remain the same for too long? So that will give us an ability to look upon the empirical life from a higher perspective. So at the beginning, I shall try to explain these three levels of reality in Vedanta. As I mentioned, the most ordinary level of reality is the level in which we live. We work, we study, we interact with things in the world, and all these things are subject to changes. It is called Vyavaharika Satta or empirical plane. Beyond that, there is the Paramarthika Satta, and that is something that goes beyond time, space, and causation. That is never subject to any changes. So in Vedanta it's called Shat Vikara Atida. That's a technical term. It means that's something which goes beyond six changes. What are these six changes? Birth, existence, growth, evolution, decay, and death. These are six changes which everything in this world has to go through. There is no escape from that. Something that coming into existence is a change from a state of empirical non-existence. something coming into existence. And then it stays for some time. It grows, it evolves, and it decays, it disappears. Now these are six changes. Everything in this empirical world is subject to these six changes. Atman is beyond these changes. So Atman remains the same in the past, present and future without any change. This is one important criterion. Transcending or going beyond any kind of changes. Six changes. The second criterion in Vedanta to decide the absolute reality is it should be experienced without any change in the three states of our consciousness, awareness. That is waking, dream and deep sleep states called Jagrat, Swapna, Susupti state. So Vedanta makes a very interesting analysis of the absolute reality without taking the help of God and theology. That's a very unique feature of Vedantic approach to absolute reality. It accepts, it recognizes the place of God, the creator God, but Vedanta tells you there is a much more accurate, a much higher approach to the absolute reality. You know why it is so very important? As I mentioned frequently, you know, the question arises, and that happens in modern times in discussions between agnostics and atheists and theists. What is the criterion of morality and ethics? On the one hand, the traditional theologians will tell you fear of God. Suppose you say, well, I don't believe in God. I don't need the help of a God. So does it mean that crime is acceptable? That morality is not needed? Vedanta gives you a much more profound philosophical foundation for morality and ethics. Vedanta tells you that God as the Atman, as one divine spark, is present in everything, present everywhere. So if you are doing harm to a person, or if you are doing harm to anything in nature, it need not be doing harm to a human being. If you cut trees down, if you burn things, if you construct a huge dam blocking the flow of water, if anything is done that damages, that creates problem for nature, or which disturbs the ecological balance, which eventually creates problem for humanity, that is an act of violence against the principle that a creation is one, because the same reality is present in everything. So you may have heard of the Vedic mantras, Devu Shanti, Antariksham Shanti, Prithivi Shanti, Roshadaya Shanti, Vanaspadaya Shanti. You find these mantras in the Yajurveda and all that. Let there be peace and happiness and blessedness in trees and mountains and valleys, sky and ocean. You find these prayers in Vedic mantras. Om Dyau Shanti Randariksham Shanti Prithivi Shanti Roshadaya Shanti Vanaspadaya Shanti. You find this, it belongs to the Yajurveda, which is at least 5,000, 6,000 years old. Let there be peace in the water, in the ocean, the skies. Not only for human beings in our own private family life, there should be peace everywhere. Because there is one interconnecting link that unifies and harmonizes the whole existence and creation. This Vedas call rhythm, which is a harmonizing, unifying, integrating principle of interrelatedness. And this rhythm has got a synonym, dharma. So if you honor this interrelatedness of creation, and go by the principle, the ethical principle of living in harmony with the whole creation, it is called dharma. So dharma and rhythm are two words which are used interchangeably. So ritena dharmena, you find rita, which is dharma. So if you violate the ecological balance of nature, it's a harm done to your next door neighbor. Because eventually you are disturbing the inherent interrelatedness harmony of creation. That's because in everything in this world, there is the presence of the divine spark. So, and that is our true identity. And that is beyond time, beyond space, and beyond causation. It is experienced without any change in waking state, dream state, deep sleep state. In waking state, we experience certain things with the help of mind and the senses of perception. In dream, we experience at the mental level. And in deep sleep, of course, we experience inner restfulness, but we are not aware of it when we experience it. So this Atman is Sakshi, it is a witness. It is the eternal seer, the subject, which is present in all of us. It's also present everywhere, and it is our true nature. And that reality is our real identity. Everything else is not wrong. Vedanta never tells you that it is the other view is wrong. Vedanta tells you the other view is only an attempt to reach this stage of experience. See, a professor teaching the university will not tell a kindergarten child or a primary school student, oh, you are all wrong. He won't say that. Because before going to this kindergarten and primary school, you cannot reach the university. The university education doesn't mean that high school education or kindergarten education is wrong or irrelevant. So this is a kind of, you know, university, a kind of ethical philosophy, a kind of universal spiritual humanism. That's a practical side of this idea of Atman as the eternal, unchanging, absolute reality. That discussion continues in the coming verse, you know. Achedyoyam. This Atman cannot be cut, cannot be pierced, it cannot be burned, it cannot be moistened. It is all-pervading, it's immovable. It is, so you find, Achedyoyam, Adakhyoyam, Akledyaha, Asoshevaja, Nitya Sarvagadasthanu Achiloyam Sanatanaka. Nitya means that which remained the same in the past, present, and future. That means it transcends time. Anything which remains the same in the past, present, and future, the line of demarcation between the past and the present and future doesn't affect that absolute reality. So, that's our true nature. And it is sarvagata, means it's all-pervading. It remains the same, but it is all-pervading. And then it is eternal. It remains the same throughout. This discussion continues. In fact, why this discussion is important? Very, 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 this Gita is highly closely knit together as a text. After an elaborate discussion of the absolute reality, Arjuna is going to ask a question in the 54th verse. That is, after 30 verses more, Arjuna will ask a question which will come to later. He asks the question, what is the nature? What are the characteristics? What are the external symptoms of a person who has reached this level of stability, this level of identification with the absolute reality? So, if you want to know the real relevance of these verses, you have to just refer to the 54th verse. You know, In the 54th verse, Arjuna is going to ask a question. Siddha prajna se ka bhasha, samadhisthasya ke shiva, siddha dikim prabhashida, kim asida vrajedakim. The question is, what are the characteristics of a sthida prajna? Sthida prajna yasya saha sthida prajna. The literal meaning is, a person whose mind, whose awareness is steady, who is a spiritually illumined person. What are the characteristics? Can you give a description of the characteristics of a woman of steady wisdom? Now, how do we attain steady wisdom when we identify ourselves with something that is steady? When we identify ourselves with the fleeting empirical objects, we can never be steady. When what we identify with, that will be the nature of our mind. See, children will go after chocolates, or maybe younger children we go for, fight for toys. And as you grow up, your concept of reality, what you want, will be something else. In course of time, all these things will change. But whatever we want, whatever we look for, whatever we are aspiring for, if that is one of these fleeting, phenomenal things, that sense objects, if it is a sense object, our mind will never be steady. Because today we want something, tomorrow we may want something else. And this desire, aspirations, what we are looking for, will continue changing. So, we identify ourselves with those things which attract our attention, our senses and mind. So, mind will be unsteady. But the moment we identify ourselves with this eternal, unchanging, the ever-steady nature, that's our real nature, Atman, then we become sthida prajna. Our wisdom, our mind becomes fully established. We become spiritually illumined. So after an elaborate discussion of this highest spiritual experience, of the highest spiritual truth, Arjuna is going to ask, maybe after 30 more verses, Arjuna will ask the question, well, now look here, Lord Krishna, please teach me the characteristics, even the external characteristics of a man of steady wisdom, calm bhasha. How does he talk? Then, you know, and how does he meditate? And how does he walk? How does he live in this world? What kind of language he speaks? And in reply to this question, Lord Krishna will explain in 18 verses the essential characteristics of a spiritually illumined soul who has identified his true spiritual nature. So, actually, the text Gita is slowly taking us to that stage. The discussion begins from 55th verse, Lord Krishna's answer, and it ends with 72nd verse. That's the end of the second chapter. So, we have to remember now, the description of this Atman, this eternal, this unchanging, the immortal reality, is preparing the background for a discussion which may have a lot to do with how we live, how we should slowly strive to attain this what you call steady wisdom, or it's called spiritual common sense. Spiritual common sense. Even intellectually, when we can think of ourselves as something other than this body and mind, it will give us a kind of spiritual common sense. That is the most visible external sign of learning Vedanta, benefits of learning Vedanta. One of the simple benefits of learning Vedanta is we'll acquire a kind of higher common sense. That spiritual wisdom expresses itself in the form of a spiritual common sense that we can employ in our everyday life. When some problem happens, oh, that's natural. We can't expect a problem-free life in this world when we are dealing with empirical things, because they are of a fleeting nature. They are not eternal. They are not essentially perfect or permanent. They are essentially imperfect and impermanent. So why should we expect perfection and permanence in things which are essentially imperfect and impermanent? So then again the discussion continues in the 26th verse. Atachainam nityajadam nityam va mannise smrutam tathavittu mahabahu naivam sochidu marhasi. So the Lord Krishna says, now, therefore, this absolute reality, it goes on changing. And it is born every day and it continuously changing. Therefore, there is no need for you to worry about anything. So, that's the idea behind. This is a common sense point of view. Jadasya dhruva mrityu, dhruvam janma mrutasya cha, tasmat aparihari arthi, nattam sojidu marhasi. Anything that comes into existence is bound to disappear. Anything that is born is bound to die. Birth and death are the same. Now, this is something that we all know. Every simple educated person will know this much. There is nobody in the world who is foolish enough to believe that our body will remain 1,000 years. Nobody thinks so. The problem is, every day we may remember, but every day we'll forget also. That's a mystery of Vedanta. So Vedanta's practical benefit is, it reminds us things that we all recognize once a while, but quickly forgets. So a person who goes to a crematorium, he won't believe, at least for half an hour at least, he won't believe that his body is going to remain for all time. A doctor who is working in a hospital will naturally know that this body is not going to last for 1,000,000 years. We all know. But every day, every moment, when we get too much worried about the ordinary things at the empirical world, when we get devastated by the slightest problem that affects our body or mind, at that moment, suddenly that wisdom is concealed. And then what happens, you know, when that wisdom is concealed, or we forget it, a false, wrong idea is projected. No, I should never fall sick. It's wrong to fall sick. I should want to live a life which is free from all problems. This desire is there, though we know intellectually it is going to be impossible for anyone. That's why, you know, one of the great answers given by a philosopher, Yudhishthira, Yakshaprasna Mahabharata, says, the greatest wonder is, Ahanya Ahanya Bhudani Gachandyahu Yamalayam. See, every day, every moment, we are witnessing this strange spectacle. Living beings, created beings of the animals, human beings, trees, and all these are marching towards what? Towards death. I mean, the palace of the Lord of Death, Yamalayam, his house. We are going to the house of death, the Lord of Death. But still, we all remember, we all want to live permanently in this world for 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years. It doesn't mean that we should not strive to live a healthy life, not at all. It doesn't mean that. We should strive to live a healthy life, physically, mentally healthy life. But when we get obsessed with that, we are actually forgetting what every day we may remember, when we read newspapers, when we go to hospitals, when we go to crematorium. So that fact, which we all know, is conveniently hidden. It is called, you know, Shankaracharya uses the word Maya. Maya is a most, one of the most wonderful doctrine in Advaita Vedanta. This Maya is something which is, in Shankara's own language, it is beyond definition, beyond description, beyond any kind of explanation, you know. So, Mahabhuda Anirvachaniya Rupa, Shankaracharya says in the Vivekachudamani. It's a great wonder. No one can understand it. No one can explain it. Maya. How this Maya operates? What you know to be sure is immediately forgotten because it is hidden from you. And then a false idea is projected in this place. Avarana and Vikshepa. Something is concealed and something else is projected in its place. So we forget immediately that everything in this world, money, wealth, status, health, all these things are goods, nothing wrong in it. In fact, Vedanta scriptures insist that every household should strive hard through proper means for acquiring wealth, money, all those things, but should not be under the wrong impression, should not have the wrong notion that they are going to remain eternal. So keep that spiritual common sense, then every householder should strive to make money, wealth. It is necessary for the survival of human civilization. Every human being who is living this world, family and children, should strive to make wealth and all that is necessary for his survival through proper means, but should not be under the wrong notion that this is the only purpose of human life. That spiritual common sense is what Vedanta gives you. So here the point is, Shankaracharya says this Maya is something that you cannot explain, cannot describe. We all know how it operates, but it is immediately forgotten, and we forget that all these things will come and go. That fact is forgotten, and the wrong notion that they should remain the same, that wrong notion is projected. That's why this 26th verse says, you know, even if you think that this Atman is going to remain for long, this body is going to remain for long, it is not going to happen. You know, then 27th verse, Jadasagi Dhruvam Mrityu, Dhruvam Janma Mrtasya Cha. Anything that is born will and should die. And also, anything that dies also will be reborn. That is part of Hindu, Buddhist, Jaina religious traditions. Most of the religious traditions that originated in the Eastern Hemisphere of the world maintain the idea of reincarnation or rebirth, and also the law of karma in some form or other. So that's why when we are born, we bring with us a bag, a box. You have no choice. What's the box or the bag? It contains all the tendencies, impressions, attitudes, behavior patterns, likes and dislikes, obsessions, prejudices, and also good qualities, all the good noble qualities that we have acquired in previous life cycles. In the subtle form, is born with us. So it's like a relay, you know, 600 meters relay, you know, the baton is exchanged. Even you cannot have to change the baton to the other person who continue running. The baton is this antakarana, which contains all the samskaras, vrittis, and all these things. That's why when we are born, certain people, we feel a strange attraction for some higher values. You have no choice. Even if you want, no, I won't meditate. I won't care for higher Vedanta principles. You can't help it. So Krishna says in the 6th chapter, Purabhyasena tenaiva kredahi avasopisaka. It means, Purabhyasa means you have been practicing meditation, good thoughts, good ideas in your previous life cycles. So you have accumulated all these healthy samskaras, tendencies. Now in this life, no, I won't be a good man. I'm going to be a bad man. You cannot be a bad person. If you have brought with you a bank which is full of good samskaras, you have no choice. So he avashaka means, you know, you have no freedom. You are totally helpless in the hands of your accumulated good samskaras that you are born with. These samskaras are deposited in the chittam, and we identify with those samskaras with aham, is called ego system. Chittam is a repository of all the samskaras, vrittis and attitudes. And mind and intellect will function according to these samskaras. That's why we sometimes feel a strange attraction towards higher things. And if we try to know, I won't be, you can't help it. Your mind will automatically go back to what samskaras you are born with. That's why, you know, Jadasya Dhruva Murtyu, Dhruvam Janma Murdasya Cha. The one who is born will die, and the one who dies will be reborn again. If he dies before he realizes his higher spiritual dimension, before he realizes that he is the Atman, if he dies, then he'll be born again. He'll be able to continue his spiritual journey in the next life. We discussed that in the last class, quoting verses from the 6th chapter. Tatradam buddhisam yogam lebhade pavrodekhikam yadadeja tado bhuyasam siddho kurunantana. All these good attitudes, good samskaras, good vrittis, good tendencies, which are deposited in the antakarana, in the buddhi or mind, they help you to continue your spiritual progression, your spiritual journey further. It will take you to the next step in this life. Tasmat abriharyarthe natum sojidumarkati. This discussion continues for a few more verses. Avyakta dini bhudani, vikta madhyani bharada, avyakta nidhana neva tatraka paridevana. So, it's being unmanifest in the beginning, and then it becomes unmanifest again in the end. Seems to be manifest in the middle. So what it means is, therefore, we see only that small, tiny fraction of the iceberg that is visible on the water, which will be 10 feet. The iceberg may be 100 feet deep. What is below the water level is not visible. But we often act according to our tendencies, looking upon what is visible in front of us as the only reality. So that should be properly understood, in fact. If we interpret and define and look at our life on the basis of the external characteristics, then we will be losing the full picture. We should try to relate our tendencies to previous life cycles and try to enrich the already accumulated positive samskaras and impressions, and that will help us to move forward. So the whole phenomenon is put together in an interesting language. This is a great wonder. One person sees this as a great wonder. Another person speaks of this as a great wonder. Another person hears this as a great wonder. It is very, very difficult to understand. In the 30th verse, so dehi nityam avadhyoyam dehi sarvasya bharata tasma sarvani bhudani nattum sojidumarkasi. So Lord Krishna says the indweller in the body, but lives in the body, that is dehi. Dehi means something that lives within deha. Dehi means the one who lives in the deha. Now, if somebody is living in a house, that person living in that house must be different from the house itself. And we are dealing with 30th verse of the second chapter. I already described the essence of these few verses. That's why I'm going fast, because there are much more important verses which sum up the whole these things together. The 30th verse is very important. Dehi means something, somebody who lives in our body. For that person, this body is the house. Now, if somebody is residing in this body, that person should be distinct from the body. What is that? That is this Atman. It is Nitya. It is eternal. Avadhyoyam. It means it cannot be killed. It is deathless. It is eternal. It is immortal. And that Dehi or Atma is residing within this body. So Swami Vivekananda talks of two approaches to this process, to this strange idea. He says, some people think we have a body and we have a soul. So body is the owner and soul is the servant. That is a kind of materialism. So spiritual philosophy tells you are a soul who has a body in which it lives. So if you say, well, I have a house, and the house has a person who resides there. It is not a proper way. You have a house and you live in your house. So here the verse tells you, Dehi, we are the owner, and this body, this mind, this intellect, and all these indriyas, mind, antakaranas, all these constitute a house in which this Atman indwells, remains, stays within. According to the type of samskaras, tendencies, impressions we have gathered, the presence of this Atman expresses itself. Now, how do you explain this multiplicity, the plurality, the differences among different human beings? According to Vedanta, the Atman remains in this psychophysical mechanism. But how that Atman manifests depends upon the type of samskaras that we have accumulated. Because the type of samskaras or impressions and tendencies that we have accumulated determine how our mind functions. So if we have good samskaras, good impressions, then that Atman manifests in a positive manner. Otherwise, that manifestation will change according to the type of tendencies. It's like a mirror. The better example is like a mirror. If the mirror is clean, pure, no dust, then you can see the sun reflects in that mirror with full effulgence. But suppose the mirror is dusty, dirty, then the reflection will not be pure. This idea is put forward by Vivekananda in a very powerful sentence. He says, the difference between an amoeba and a Buddha is one of degrees, not of kind. What it means is, in an amoeba, the mirror is very thick, very dusty. Maybe it's also among people who have wrong tendencies, the Atman, the indweller, is not able to reflect with full effulgence. So when we pray, when we meditate, when we read books, when we enrich and feed our mind with positive spiritual thoughts, that can be done through so many different ways. Can reading holy books, associating with holy persons, discussion among like-minded spiritual seekers, discussion and debates and exchange of ideas among like-minded spiritual seekers, All these are different ways of feeding our mind with good spiritual food. It's just like taking a piece of cloth, removing all the dust from the surface of the mirror. Once all the dust is removed, then the sun reflects in pure form. That's why Vivekananda says, the difference between an amoeba and a Buddha is one of degrees, but not of kind. Means, it's not that Atman is not present in one entity. Atman is present in Buddha only. No, Atman is present in everywhere. So, all spiritual practices, or any kind of activity that somehow enriches our mind with spiritual tendencies is a way of removing the dust, cleaning the mirror that is our own mind. So, with this we will finish today's session and we have interaction. You can ask questions according to your choice. Most welcome discussion.
So I am gifted with five senses and they fill the mind with these impermanent objects and they keep me from seeing that self within. So how do you deal with that fact that we are distracted from seeing that self within?
Yeah. So Vedanta gives seven disciplines, four at the first stage and three at the second stage. The first stage, it talks about sadhana chatushtayam. That means, in Sanskrit, it's called nitya nitya vastu viveka iha mutra bhala bhoga viraka samadhi sarka sambhati mumokshuttam. In English, say, first of all, we must analyze, we must use our discerning power to find out what is real and what is unreal. And then we must slowly develop a kind of aversion towards things which we know very well to be unreal, to be a problem for our spiritual progress. And then slowly we will be able to practice a kind of renunciation, kind of detachment towards things which could be problematic in our spiritual life. So actually, we cannot shut out our indriyas, our senses. We should divert our mind and the senses into positive channels. The control of the senses happens when you first acquire the ability to divert them to positive channels. So, mind is going to various undesirable channels because it's flowing through the eyes, the senses of perception, ears, sense of touch, sense of smell, sense of taste, and so on. All the five senses of perception, jnana indriyas we call, are dragging the mind towards various sense objects. This is what happens all the time. Now, this tendency of the mind to flow towards various sense objects can be put to good use. You turn this tendency towards positive experiences, like positive interactions with others. Instead of seeing undesirable things, see good things, reading books, listening to good things, and also interacting our senses and mind with positive, spiritually healthy, spiritually helpful channels. So, diverting our senses towards healthy channels is the first natural step towards turning them towards Atman, towards higher idea. That's the natural step. Some people will tell you, you should not see anything. If you physically take an obsession, well, I won't see that. Mentally, you'll be seeing only that. You know. Suppose we take a strong decision. Tomorrow onwards, I won't hear particular music or anything. But mentally, you'll be always, well, because you have to remember not to hear it. So mentally, you'll be hearing. Mentally, you'll be seeing, which is not different from physically seeing and hearing. So what you should do, the natural tendency of the senses to turn towards external objects should be diverted towards positive channels instead of reading undesirable things, we can read good things, we can listen to good things, we can interact with positive, spiritually helpful channels. So first, diverting mind to a healthy channel is the first step before diverting the mind towards Atman. So once we do that, then we become convinced of the unreality or the transitory nature of external things. Then naturally our mind will turn towards something higher. So this was then Sravana Manana Nididhyasana in Sanskrit is called, means hearing, reading, feeding our mind with good ideas, reading spiritually healthy item books or whatever it is, and then thinking, contemplating, internalizing. All these will help us to slowly turn our mind towards something higher, towards something transcendental. You know the story, sometimes we very glibly, in a very superficial sense, we use the word, we should control the mind. It is, actually it is a mockery, it is a big lie. We cannot control the mind at the beginning. We can turn the mind towards good things. That's the first step. It is, the story goes, you know, a person who was losing his hair went to an Ayurvedic doctor to make fun of him. Do you have medicine for this? Actually, the Ayurvedic doctor knew this fellow was making fun of him. So he told him, you know, you should never think of an egg. If you think of an egg, your head also will be like that. But this man, from that day onwards, he was struggling to avoid thinking of an egg. But that involves thinking of it first. Then he would try to avoid it, you know. So he was always working hard to avoid thinking of an egg. But for that, you should first of all think of it. Then he would struggle to avoid thinking of it. So he became completely bald-headed. So frequently, when we forcibly try to shut out our mind, the effect is not very pleasant. Buddha, in his famous discourse, it is called Satyupatthana Sutta in Pali, Smriti-upasthana Sutra in Sanskrit, is the original discourse of Buddha, which is the Bible of mindfulness. So the whole concept of mindfulness is built upon this famous discourse of Buddha, which is in Pali, it's available, maybe in Kuddhaka Nikaya, one of the Tripitaka's texts you'd find. So how to slowly turn the mind towards good things, and then you should try to observe everything as a witness, but you cannot do that at the beginning. For a beginner, mind is always being dragged towards various sense objects. The eyes, the ear, the sense of touch, sense of smell, sense of taste, all these five senses are dragging the mind towards various sense objects. If you say, no, tomorrow onwards, I won't do that. You may, physically you may keep your eyes closed, but mentally you will be seeing what you want to avoid seeing. You know. So also hearing, etc. A person will say, tomorrow onwards, I won't eat that. But if the desire is there, mentally he'll be eating, tasting it. So it will have the same binding effect. So what a person should do, he should divert the mind towards healthy channels. And that way mind will slowly start moving. Mind will get refined. Mind will accumulate positive samskaras, healthy samskaras, vrittis, healthy tendencies, and then mind will become slowly steady. That's the process. Okay, now I think we have one more, we have time for one more question, then we'll come to come.
Yeah. Swamiji, how does Vedanta explain if Atman is eternal, all-pervading, present everywhere, immobile, how does it explain how and why there's changing reality then?
Oh yeah. You know, the so-called changing realities, as changing realities are unreal, But behind the changing realities, there's a substratum which is unchanging. So, Vedanta tells you, when you look at the world as world, it is nothing but empirical, changing, non-eternal, is a fleeting phenomenon. Now, suppose one day you attain the highest degree of Advaitic experience. Still, you will be living in this world. You will be still living in the same house in which you are living. You will be eating the same food which you are eating. Nothing changes. But what happens, you know, the way you see these things, the way your perspective will undergo a complete change. That is, even in the midst of all these, we will not forget the transitoriness or momentariness, the impermanent nature of these empirical things. Remembering that, we will be interacting with these things. So the world itself, as world, is not different from Brahman. World as world is unreal. World as Brahman with the substratum is real. I shall try to explain again with the help of an example. Now look at, say, suppose there are 1,000 pots and pans made of clay. Now, if you are a pot maker, you only look at these different shapes. You may be judging the quality of a product. Maybe you may be thinking of the quality of the clay. If you're a goldsmith, let's say, a jewelry shop owner, and somebody comes to you to sell an old golden ornament, and your plan is you want to melt that golden ornament and you may make something else, some other ornament from it. Now, if a person comes to your jewelry shop, you won't be thinking about the beauty, the workmanship, the quality of that necklace or ring or whatever it is. You'll be looking at the quality of the gold because your plan is to melt it and make something else out of it. Similarly, when a person reaches the highest degree of Advaitic experience, he'll be still seeing this world. Even while looking at the world, he will be looking at it, but will be looking it as non-different from Brahman. A jewelry shop owner looking at a golden ornament who judges everything only on the basis of the quality of the gold. So far as he is concerned, all these are different names and forms. He may have golden biscuits in his store. That's what they do these days. And out of that he may made all 1,000 or 10,000 different golden ornaments. But in his mind, he will be only thinking of the gold, quality of gold. The size and shape, different shapes of golden ornaments, so he gives different names, all these things, so far as he is concerned, are immaterial. Like that, when you reach the highest degree of Advaitic experience, you don't run away from the world, you'll continue living in the world, but you'll be looking at the world in a totally different fashion. You know, in actual practical life, you know what happens? Your whole priority changes. There is a change, the reprioritization, that's what happens. You may continue living the world. If you are a businessman, you continue your business. You don't shop, close your shop and go away because you have realized Brahman. No. You will continue running the shop. But there will be change in your attitude. One day, you don't have enough profit. It was a bad day. You won't be shocked. So I shall give the example in the Mahabharata, one of the greatest expositions of Vedanta comes in the Mahabharata, not Bhagavad Gita. Actually, it is much more profound. It's called Vyatha Gita. Gita means a song. Vyatha is a, you know, Vyatha, who was, Vyatha by profession was a butcher, not a very desirable profession from a Vedantic perspective. You may think, but it's not so. The Vyatha was a great teacher. But he had done a lot of spiritual practice and he was a realized person and did not close his shop and go away. He continued doing his duty. So I shall, within 2 minutes I shall continue, I shall finish because it's a very important subject. There's a very interesting discussion in the Mahabharata. It is called, Padivrata Brahmachari Samvadaha. A dialogue between a chaste woman, a chaste wife, and a housewife, wonderful, a spiritually enlightened housewife, and an ascetic. An ascetic was doing meditation for a long time, and he sat under a tree. He very proud of his spiritual attainments. At least according to him, so one day there was a disturbance on the upper branch of the tree, and he looked. He found two birds were fighting. So he was highly disturbed in his meditation. So he got angry with them. He looked at them. They burned to ashes. The story goes. It's a mythological story. This is just a context. This is not the main part of the story. Then he became very proud of his, you know, miraculous powers. And he left that place. He went in search of, you know, just like in the medieval Europe, the Franciscan friars to go about, you know, alms for Saint Francis. Like that, Bhavadi Bhiksham Dehi. Great ascetics used to move from place to place, and standing in front of a householder's house, he will say, please give me alms. So somebody will come out and give alms, and he will proceed further. This is how great ascetics, wandering ascetics, lived in ancient India. They may be emperors, kings, who turned to asceticism. There are examples like that in the mythological books. So this man went to the house of an householder. The old man, husband, was not there. The old lady was there. So this man said, please give me alms. Then from inside the kitchen, a voice came, sir, please wait. So this man got angry. Why? How dare you ask me to wait? What a great ascetic I am. I could burn the birds into ashes. I'm not a small man. But you know, the moment this arrogant thought flashed in his mind, the lady's voice came again. Sir, don't get angry. There are no birds here for you to burn into ashes. And this ascetic got surprised. He was surprised. How did this old lady know what happened in the forest? But he was, you know, because he was a spiritual seeker, he had the ability to turn the flashlight into his own mind. So he recognized his own mistake. He became humble. Mother, please forgive me. Who is your teacher? How did you get this power to know what happened in the forest many miles away? The lady said, I am a humble housewife. I do my duty properly and then I pray. But if you want to know about my teacher, you can go a few miles away from here. There is a place to give proper direction, and he went there. And you know where he landed? He reached the shop of a butcher who was cutting meat. You know, maybe wagons will be there. Don't get offended or annoyed. The point is, the greatness of the Vedantic philosophy you can see here in real, in action. So this butcher was sitting there. When the ascetic, remember the ascetic, you had to admire him. Because he had meditated, he was a sincere seeker, he had the wisdom to be humble and to evolve further. That's why he became so humble. He wanted to learn from the poor housewife, old woman, and she directed him to the butcher, but this man was still, he was so humble, so that's the advantage of even doing some spiritual practice. You would be able to turn the flashlight into your own mind and recognize and find out where I have done something wrong. I should not do it. That ability is what distinguishes an ordinary person from a genuine spiritual seeker. So this man went to the place and butcher was sitting there. A long line of customers waiting for him. So the butcher told him, oh, you were sent by that lady who told you about you burning the birds, you know. This man was surprised because he had traveled many miles. You see, the story is put somewhere in the 3rd millennium BC, 5,000 years back. So she had traveled many miles before reaching the butcher's place. And the butcher told him, please sit there for some time. Let me send off these customers who are waiting for me. And of course, after some time he waited, Then he said, what do you want? What brought you here? This man said, you know, I understood that you are a great teacher, and the lady directed me here. Then Vyatha Gita, long discussion of Vedanta, Vyatha's exposition of Gita. And Vyatha's story goes like this. He was himself, was a great spiritual seeker, left his home when he was small, did meditation and prayer for long years in the forest, became an enlightened person, but did not give up his profession. In the long discussion, he tells the ascetic, look here, this is the work that I inherited from my father. In those days, you know, 5,000 years back, you can't get a new job because you're highly qualified. You know. You have to continue the same job. This is the work which I inherited from my family, from my father. I don't know anything else. So I continue doing this to the best of my ability. So a karma yogi, or a person who practices karma yoga, he doesn't worry about what he does. He does it with total detachment, but complete concentration. In full concentration, full focus, but he is not obsessed by his own desire for the benefits. So the calmness, the quietude with which he expounds Vedanta is a classic. Because Shankaracharya wrote a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, it became a world universal spiritual classic. Because of Shankaracharya's masterly touch. Vyatha Gita is not inferior to Bhagavad Gita. So we'll continue maybe in the next session. Thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tatsat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.